Welcome to Grad Chat by PhD Balance, where we talk about topics of grad school beyond academic research and that sometimes may be more difficult to talk about. I'm your host, Courtney Applewhite. My pronouns are she, her, and hers. I'm a PhD candidate in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara, studying deaf. Don't forget to subscribe to Grad Chat on your chosen platform to get notifications about new episodes, and do leave us a review or rating if you have time. It helps people find our podcast and gets the word out. Our topic today is navigating difficult topics, and I'm excited to welcome our guest, Tierre Riggins. Tierre is a current biomedical engineering PhD researcher at Case Western Reserve University who has just become the first Black biomedical engineering PhD recipient from MSU. She received her bachelor's in biomedical engineering from The Ohio State University in 2011, also becoming the first Black undergraduate student to receive a bachelor's in science in BME from OSU, and proceeded to earn a master's from the University of Cincinnati in 2013. Beginning her PhD at Purdue in 2014, she transferred to Michigan State in January 2019. Her research focuses integrating tissue engineering with implantable electrodes to tune immune response in the brain in the REIL, or REAL lab, under the direction of Dr. Aaron Purcell. She is the co-founder of Black for Black in Neuro, serves as the academic chair for the Health Innovation Special Interest Group of the National Society of Black Engineers, is a local organizer for ComSciCon Michigan, and is in the Speakers Bureau for the Rape and Incest National Network. She has also served in the community under her platforms of sexual assault awareness and exposing underrepresented students in STEM as Miss Indiana United States 2015, and has received awards for her social justice in 2016 and humanitarianism in 2018. She was named a fellow in the Society for Neuroscience from 2016 to 2018, and is also an NIH F99K00 fellowship awardee. She just accepted a postdoc position in the Cappadona lab at Case Western Reserve University, where she will do her funded research. Her future goals include managing her own lab, exploring neurodegeneration and foreign body response to brain-computer interfaces, and being a successful educator and mentor for students who are underrepresented students in neuroscience and engineering. So it sounds to me like you're not very busy. We're so pleased to have you on and talk about more about you. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Sorry, like I can't talk. This is not a good day to not be able to talk. Thank you. It's like an honor to be suggested for an invite to chat with you guys.
Yeah, no, we're so happy to have you. And there's so many different ways that we can kind of go to talk about, because what we're talking about today is navigating difficult topics or difficult situations within grad school. And it sounds like you have experience in a lot of different realms. So we know graduate school can be a really positive experience, but we all know it does come with challenges. So for you, what has been the most challenging part of your grad school experience?
I honestly believe like the most challenging experience was probably like my whole entire time that I was at Purdue. So I started at Purdue in 2014, all in biomedical engineering, and I transferred schools in 2019. I transferred schools without an advisor, which is almost unheard of. But I really did not have a good start there. I did not fit well into the department. And honestly, a lot of students didn't, but it wasn't because of the students per se, it was more because of the department. And I say that because there isn't really good mentoring, or at least while I was there, a lot of PIs did not mentor. And it was a very kind of like rough place. And if they thought that you didn't belong, they were actively pushing you out. So when I started in 2014, I was in my first lab. But when I was in my first lab, my first semester, I was sexually assaulted. And so that affected my work and my productivity, like in the lab. So even though I had a high GPA and I passed my qualifiers with high marks, I was still getting pushed out. I was being told that I didn't have what it takes. So my first advisor pushed me out of her lab and I switched labs. And the thing about that was that she was actually trying to leave the university. She wanted to have the head of the department position, but the then current head wasn't like moving or budging or wasn't allowing her to do so. So she ended up leaving the university, and she left the university with or without students. So, and what I mean by that is that a lot of students did not want to leave with her, and she was just trying to get rid of them, essentially. So there was actually a lot of complaints against her within the grad school, basically about what they did. And then I did work briefly for another PI, but I was his first student. And so it seems like there was a lot of like, not babysitting, but like a lot of pressure, and it wasn't really an established lab. And even though I did really good work for him and he actually liked the work that I did, the head of the department was grading me. So the head of the department really didn't want me there. And he actually has a history of like kind of pushing out underrepresented students, which is a whole nother discussion topic. But I did finally land into another lab. I thought I was gonna be safe. What happened was that lab's, you know, start to lose funding, not because we were just, you know, doing the wrong thing or she was just losing, but she was losing funding because she wasn't applying for grants. And the reason why she had stopped applying for grants was because she accepted an admin position. So there I was feeling like the rug was being pulled underneath me again. And, you know, even though I was high performing, I was meeting my milestones, like exceeding them. I went to go to my prelim and I didn't have the support of my committee. And my committee literally set me up to fail. And so at my prelim, they told me that I did not pass and they violated the hand rule book. And they said that I could not try to take it again, even though in the handbook it says that I could take it again. So it was a lot. And you know, even with all that going on, I was also being blackmailed by the department because I was speaking up about my treatment there. And I was very visible because I was a former Miss Indiana. So I was talking about my treatment on campus, what I was going through with the sexual assault and kind of like the, you know, the racism and sexism I was kind of facing there. So the department did not want me, even though I was high performing. So when I failed my prelim and they tried to not give me the option of like, you know, redoing it again, they tried to make me take another master's, even though I had a master's from Cincinnati. And I told them, I have a master's from Cincinnati. Like, why do I need a second master's in the same field? And they're like, oh, this is Purdue Engineering. And I'm like, absolutely not. This is unacceptable. So the day or 2 days after I passed my prelim, I actually went to ComSciComm Michigan. And it was a life-changing, you know, it was life-changing simply because I applied for that program. I got in. I did not know what was going to happen. After I failed my prelims and I went there, I kind of just brought my resume and I passed it around and I talked to different people. And I talked to professors who were at MSU and UM and they were looking at my resume and they're just like, there's no way that you should, you know, be in this situation. So I actually talked to people who believed in me, who wanted me to give another chance, who were like, you should totally leave Purdue. So that was like my whole entire time that I've been, it's been nothing but like, something on top of each other, which was crazy because even though all these things were happening, I was still performing as a student.
Yeah, that's, I mean, totally unacceptable. Doesn't even really cover it, but like the amount of just systematic issues that sounds like is going on in that particular department is overwhelming, and it's a lot to combat as a single student, or even if there was a group of students that could like band together, it's still really, really challenging to go against such a set departmental norm or a departmental culture. And I think that that's something that a lot of students can, you know, empathize with even. And so you did make this decision eventually to leave Purdue. And so was it just a culmination of all of this and then just the support of those external people that you met that kind of like led you to be able to then leave?
Yes, because I was totally considering like leaving altogether and just like, I have a master's, I'm gonna go to industry, forget it. But I was involved in a few programs that kind of held me tight, for lack of better words, who like I had a very strong support system. So I was in Society for Neuroscience, the fellows program, and I had mentors that I met and people that I met through that program who were just supporting me and just kind of treating me with kid's glove or like handholding and just like, well, you know, here's what's going on. Here's some of your options. Let's sit down and talk together and see how we can figure things out. And I remember I was talking on the phone with one of my mentors that I met through the program, and she was just like, you better go to this conference. You better print out resumes. You better talk to people because your experience is insane. And I don't understand why they can't see that they have a good student in you, but you can go somewhere else and thrive. You don't deserve to go through this. And I'm so glad that I took her advice, because after my prelim, I was super depressed. I laid in the bed crying. And she forced me out of the bed to go to this conference, which was a great idea, because I was talking to people and I talked to the speakers, I talked to professors, and they're like, yeah, you should totally get out. And so I was encouraged to apply to MSU and UM programs. And it was like that. It was just like history. Like, I spent the rest of the semester trying to get ready for my move to Michigan. I found a really great advisor at MSU. I thought her work was amazing. And it was still somewhat related to the work that I was doing. So I was doing a neural engineering focused work while I was at Purdue. And then I moved to another neural engineering lab, just a different topic. But it totally worked out, and I'm so glad it did.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that it sounds like you wielded really well is the support networks that you got outside of the university, which I think are sometimes undervalued. So if students are sort of facing this challenge in their own departments, is that what you would recommend to them, that they go to conferences, that they go seek support networks elsewhere?
Yes. So as a grad student, I think it's very important that you try not to be a silo, to get involved in organizations and professional societies, or even just be active on social medias, because sometimes you can find a really good support system just on the internet. So reach out. Don't be by yourself, because like, when you have a network and you have people who like understand and empathize with you, they can help you, but you can also too turn around and help them. So I believe that's like very, very important. And I think that my network of people and other friends I had, like my extended science family, I think they really helped me.
Yeah, I think that building up that network is critical. And it's, I think it is really easy to get stuck in your university and in your department. And so I think it's really important that you were able to see outside of that and then move to a space. And it sounds like now you're having a much better experience in where you ended up at.
Yeah. Yeah. When I moved to Michigan State, I finally found the PhD advisor who actually cared about me and my development as a scientist and as a person. And if it wasn't for her mentorship, I don't think I would have matriculated. So I transferred and I went to MSU, and I literally completed a PhD in 3 years and then earned a fellowship, which was a completely different story from where I was at Purdue. Purdue, I was there for like 4.5 years. People were telling me I couldn't do it. And then I, you know, transfer schools, get a, you know, actual good advisor, and then end up with an NIH fellowship and like 3 more publications. So yeah, that was definitely a life-changing experience, because I literally was ready to like say, screw it, walk it out, and just try to start over elsewhere.
Yeah. So now that you have the benefit of hindsight, what were the, do you think you would have seen, like, what do you think the red flags were when going into the program at Purdue? So if a student is shopping around at labs or shopping at departments, and you know they're going in for these interviews and deciding where they want to go, do you know now like what you might have seen that would have given you an insight that this kind of thing might have happened?
Gosh, I really don't think there was anything that stuck out to me that was like, oh, this is going to be a very bad experience for you, because things really started happening when I was there. But I think when I was interviewing in the interviewing class, I was like the only Black woman. So maybe like not being the only person in a program would help a lot. You could definitely find, not saying that you can't find community, but it's so much easier to find community and people who like look like you. But also too, when you go and you interview for departments and you see the departments are not diverse, or they don't have a lot of women, or you know, they're all one race, that's not a good thing, because usually that means that they aren't recruiting diverse talent. They have no value in seeing that or doing that. And if they did have diverse talent, a lot of them have left for other reasons. So I would pay attention not only to the students, but also to like the faculty, like how well they're being represented. Also the attitude of the general department, if people are very open to helping students versus if they don't mentor. And it's kind of hard to see if someone's gonna be a good mentor or not, but one of the giveaways, and a lot of times you really can't understand this until you go into a lab, but one of the giveaways there is that when you go into lab and a student asks for help and the PI doesn't want to help them, or they try to completely put work off on other students who are there, that means they don't want to actively mentor. They expect you to already come in knowing. And the problem with that is that research is a taught skill set. No one is born knowing how to do research. So when an advisor comes and tells you, hey, you're not a good enough researcher, you don't have the skills, that's a reflection on them. They're the one who's failing you. It's not you that have the issue, it's them, because they don't want to teach you the tool set you need to be a successful researcher.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because I think that's exactly right. And there's something very gatekeepy about the notion that like somehow you're just supposed to know these things without being taught them. Like it's mm-hmm. very like, it's excluding to a lot of people who don't have access to that kind of knowledge before they get to grad school, or haven't had those kinds of opportunities, or don't have that network or parents or whatever that are in academia and can tell them these things. So I think that that's a great point. And I was going to ask, you sort of alluded to this, so are there any questions that you can think of that people could ask? Like, I guess they could ask, like, is there a lot of mentorship in the lab? Or like, are there things that people can ask to kind of get to some of this if they're looking for programs?
So I would definitely try to get a feel or a vibe for the lab. I would try to figure out what is the advisor's kind of mentorship style. I would try to figure out if they are micromanagers or if they're laid back. I would also try to figure out if you go to the lab, will the advisor be happy to explain? Will they take time out of the day to explain things to you? Or will they just be like, oh, you should already know this already? That's a red flag. Or if you go into a lab and everyone's hyper-competitive, they don't trust each other, that's a bad, you know, atmosphere or vibe for the lab. And usually when there's a bad vibe for a lab, the PI has set that bad vibe or that bad tone. So I will look at that. I will look at the work-life balance, because you don't want to live your life in the lab forever. You don't want to work those crazy hours because you need work-life balance. And then I would also see like how social the lab is too, because sometimes when people come in, they're in the lab, no one wants to be social. That's usually not a good sign either. It means that they don't get along, or like even the PI itself is like forcing some kind of intense pressure, or like kind of causing people to compete with, you know, against each other, which is also not good.
Yeah. And I think that one of the takeaways might be too, is to talk to other grad students. And I sort of always recommend this to students that are shopping for different departments, is to talk to current graduate students to see what their impressions are, to get their experiences, because advisors or PIs might tell you one thing, but then you're going to get a different perspective from the grad students that are actually in it at the time.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah. Okay, well, I guess to pivot a little bit, I know that you're also really active in, well, you're the co-founder of Black in Neuro, and there was a big movement on Twitter where the Black in X movement, where people are showing representation in these fields that have been historically underrepresented. Can you talk a little bit more about your involvement with that and what that's given you in your grad student career?
So the Black in X movement kind of started around in summer 2020. It was a response to the whole Amy Cooper, Christian Cooper fiasco, in which Amy Cooper, I laugh because not because it's a funny situation, but because they have the same last name. But Amy Cooper, she was walking her dog in Central Park. Christian Cooper was there. He was bird seeing, and her dog was unleashed, and he asked her kindly to leash her dog, and she kind of just lost it and kind of pretended that this guy was like harassing her or trying to assault her. And so she made a big deal about it and cried and called the police and tried to get her arrested. And, you know, people had this on camera kind of showing what she was doing. And so it blew up, and she obviously got in a lot of trouble for it. She lost her job. People were trying to take her dog away from her too. And Christian Cooper is a birder. So he's a scientist. And so on Twitter, a lot of Black scientists, like prior to 2020, felt like we didn't have a voice or people wasn't really paying attention to us. So when that happened, people were like, okay, let's start the Black Birders Week, which was like the first Black in X week. And so when they tweeted about that and they got together and they did their programming, a bunch of other Black scientists and engineers were like, oh, I do this, I do that. What about Black in chemistry? What about Black in astro? So people were literally forming teams or groups of Black in X basically off of tweets. And a lot of these folks were trainees. Trainees and early career researchers. So literally, Angeline, our founder, Angeline Dukes, Dr. Dukes, she just graduated. She tweeted sometime around July 4th, what about Black in neuro? And so like we all responded, like 22 different people responded to her post and was like, oh yeah. And we just kind of like formed, not really a gang, but we just kind of formed, you know, this coalition of Black in neuro and decided to start, you know, making or planning programming for the week and gathering people together all within a month. And it got a lot of traction and a lot of donations. And now officially we're 501c3. We're planning again for our third annual Black in Neuro Week, which is last week in July. So if you go to blackinneuro.com, you'll see our schedule. If you want to sign up or join the newsletter, go ahead and do that, check it out. But that's literally how we came together, and we've just been growing ever since.
Yeah. And it sounds like, again, so you're sort of forming these support networks of people who are in, like you said, like a similar position to you and a similar positionality to you, to give yourself support and offer support to other people who maybe are trying to pursue that area of expertise, you know, like to give them, we're here and we're doing things, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very rewarding. Like, I can imagine, like, it's definitely like a lot of work, but everybody on our team is very, very supportive, and everybody is also very busy. So we're very cognizant and aware of our time and everyone else's time. And it's just been great working with people who are so ambitious and organized and like very on it about things and like just very courteous and kind. And like you get on the calls, everyone, they're just like, how are your day and how's it going? And like I haven't even seen most of the folks in person, but I feel like I just have this deep connection with them. And when I see them, it's just gonna be amazing, like finally. So
yeah, I mean I think that's really valuable. And I'm really pleased that has been a positive outcome of a really like terrible and annoying situation that was the sort of origin story of it. But it sounds like it's going to do a lot of good out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. Our members and our membership is amazing too, as well. Like people are very, very organized, very accomplished, but also very talented. And it's just been real exciting, even learning about what different members are doing, research-wise or even hobby-wise, and just getting to know these people. It's just been an amazing ride, really.
Yeah, and that's great. But I want to take a step back because I think it's important for us to acknowledge that a lot of the struggle that you faced while you were at Purdue and while you were having these experiences, it sounds like you sort of identified some of it as racism, as like specifically being targeted because of your race. And I was wondering if you might be willing to share your experience with that and maybe a reflection of some of the experiences you might have heard of from your cohort in Black and Neuro and the kinds of things that you have to engage with to be in the positions that you've gotten to.
Yeah, so one thing that I think resonated with me when we started Black in Neuro was a lot of the feedback on our programming was, oh my God, thank you for creating a program like this, because I felt so alone in my program. I was the only one. I didn't feel like I didn't have any like support. And I didn't know I had this community until like you guys popped up online. And then I saw other people and, you know, different programs across the country or even across the world that were like experiencing the same thing. So, I mean, on the most basic level, a lot of underrepresented students are faced microaggressions, but like, as a woman yourself, I know you understand, like, when you are in a space and you're the only one, or there's so very little of you, people judge you and think that you're less than or you're less capable. So you'll hear or experience microaggressions, but even those microaggressions over time build up. So it's one thing to get stung by a bee once, but it's another thing to get stung by 52 different bees in, you know, in different places. So then the 52 bees, after they build up over time, you feel like you're hurt and you don't want to deal with it anymore. Same thing with microaggressions. After you keep facing things over and over and over again, where like otherwise other people who may not look like you don't have to deal with that, or they may even be subjecting you to microaggressions that they are unaware of, after time that hurts. And then you feel like you don't belong. And then a lot of times it affects how you feel about your work and how yourself. So then you're thinking, wow, do I actually, you know, belong? Like, should I be here? You know? And that's the thing. So like when you're in that situation and you're facing, you know, racism or any of the isms, sexism, homophobia, whatever, it starts to affect you. It starts to affect your livelihood as a person. And if one of your identities is a scientist or a researcher, it starts to affect that work too. So not only do you have to worry about the normal pressures and the hardness of grad school, because grad school should be hard, because you should be learning, you know, in grad school, you're uncovering knowledge, you're creating something new. So you're uncovering knowledge, or you're bringing something new into the world. So it's going to be difficult. But the problem is, that's the only thing that should be difficult about grad school, is that process, not because you decided to wake up and be a researcher one day because of how you look. Like, it shouldn't be that way. Anybody anywhere who wakes up, any Black or brown girl, any queer person, any trans person, anybody should wake up and be like, oh, I want to be a scientist or researcher. And they should be able to have access to the resources and tools to be the best scientist or researcher they can be without facing all this crap because of what they look like.
Yeah, I think that I totally agree, because grad school is hard, and it has to be hard because you are pushing yourself beyond the limits of what most people are, you know, you're pushing your knowledge and pushing knowledge of the world ahead. But it's those additional burdens that not everyone has that make grad school really, really untenable for some people. And, you know, as you reflected on earlier, the fact that there weren't any Black women in your department. Some of that, I mean, we know now, like, there's tons of research that suggests that it's because of these burdens that are placed on different types of people, different types of underrepresented groups. It's not the research, it's all the other stuff, right? It's right. All that additional stuff.
Right. And there's, you know, and the nature of academia is very gatekeepy. For example, like, you have to shell out $300 to study for the GRE and take the GRE and get high enough scores. People with low socioeconomic backgrounds, that $300 is going to be a big hurdle. And the time that they're going to take to try to figure out how they can save up money working odd jobs for that takes away time from them to study. So they're not as competitive because they don't have the same resources as someone who comes from a rich background.
Exactly. And even the applications to get into grad school, you know, right, those are expensive. And right, then you have to relocate across the country sometimes without any relocation costs. It's like every step is designed to prevent. Yeah, it's preventative for certain like socioeconomic backgrounds and different people to get into grad school.
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough, right? I mean, and it's systematic. And I think that what we see the challenge, and what one of the challenges that you're addressing with just the your ability to push through all of the bullshit, frankly, is that it, and with the movements like Black and X are showing like that representation to show that it can be done and show ways in which people can get there. Because, you know, if you don't see anyone that looks like you, it's really hard to even imagine how you might end up like in a position to be a researcher, to be a PhD, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and another thing that you sort of talk about, or, you know, one of the things that you're involved with is the Rape and Incest National Network. So can you tell me a little bit about your involvement with that, what led you to be involved, and, you know, how that's impacted your journey in grad school?
So 2015 was the year that I won Miss Indiana United States. I actually got into pageants because I lost a bet. One of my friends from organization, she was a former Miss Black Ohio, and then she's just like, you should do pageants. So I was just like, my idea of pageants, like, I'm a feminist and I don't think I would be a good pageant girl, because I had a very shallow idea of what, you know, title holders do. Then I found out that title holders, when they compete in pageants, that's like one small portion of like what they actually do. They're required, like when they get a title and they compete and they win, they have a year's long work of work. And their work is about their platform, what they do in the community, going, giving out talks, volunteering, all that. Like that's like 90% of being a title holder. The 10% is actual pageant. I mean, that pageant part is very intense, but you do have like a whole platform to build, because every organization wants their title holder to be a leader and a woman that other women and other girls can look up to. And so I competed and I got involved and I was doing things that I wanted to based on the platform that I build off of. And I was thinking like, this is amazing, because for whatever reason, people see a crown and sash and they want to listen to you. Or little girls be like, oh, what do you do? Do you live in a castle? I'm like, okay, no, I live in a lab and I'm a scientist. Yay, science. So I love that aspect. And when I became Miss Indiana in 2015, this was right after my assault in 2014 at Purdue. So I chose to speak up my platform about sexual assault and sexual assault survivors, but also about women in STEM. And so I reached out to Rape and National Network because at the time, Purdue did not have a Rape Crisis Center. They did not have resources available for us, and actually was part of a social justice group that was petitioning and protesting against the university to have a Rape Crisis Center, because at the time it was the only Big Ten school that did not have one. So I reached out to Rape and National Rape and Incest National Network because I went to their website and used a lot of their resources to figure out things, to know what to do. And so I was like, this is an organization that helped me a lot because there was nothing on campus. And so I reached out to them. I told them what I was going through and what happened. They were like, great, you can be a speaker. And so I've actually have had like speaker opportunities talking about the work that I've done and then how RAIN has helped me and why I chose to or applied to become a speaker in the Speakers Bureau.
Yeah, that's such important work. And I think that it reflects a lot on the sort of the general failings of the university to not provide these kinds of services, and then students having to step up and take those roles, like, you know, with you being a representative for that organization that can then bridge the divide. But yeah, I think that that's so important. I think you made a great point about pageants in general, because I actually know a lot of people who participate in pageants and they just get so much out of them, you know, like they learn a lot about public speaking, which is so important in academia and in like so many forms of, you know, so many different avenues of life, and, you know, about sort of being well-spoken, you know, being able to talk about a platform, because I think that everyone likes to make jokes about how it's all very like world peace and sort of things like that, but today, like, it's very nuanced, the positions that women take in these organizations. So I think that that's and not to mention, I know this is probably a shallower version of it, but like, you can win prize money from competing in pageants. And I think that, like, frankly, it's an underutilized source of income for people.
It
gives you a lot of skills and you can make some money.
Absolutely. Yeah, little known fact, Miss America is like the biggest scholarship awardee of women in the country. And people just think, oh, it's a pageant, it's nothing. No, Miss America has given hundreds of thousands of scholarships over the years. So,
yeah. I mean, you know, hate all you want, but there's some legitimacy in it, you know?
Right.
And, you know, it's the women that participate in them that shape the pageants, right? So we can, you know, you can make sort of a feminist viewpoint argument that like, oh, it's about the objectification of women. And I'm like, no, if women are using this pageant for a platform, like it's not necessarily about, it's not about their objectification. It's about their voices and about their platform that they're developing. So I think it's, it does, it requires just a mentality shift in how you consider how women can wield their own voice in these particular ways.
Right. I totally agree, because looking at different systems, some systems, for instance, require a costume section. So a lot of women have used their costume section for like either their city, state, country, as like a form of protest even. So like, gosh, I'm trying to think of one that I can name of exactly, but I've even seen a few in like Miss USA where like, or not even the Miss USA, but the Miss Universe system, where I've seen people from different countries, they would have like a statement piece about like what was going on, like, you know, where they're from. Like Miss Michigan USA one year, she dressed, I don't know if it was a dress or something, but she said, "Hi, I'm Miss Michigan, and I'm from the one state that has like the most access to fresh water. However, people in Flint are dying because of lack of access." Like people have used their platforms on a national and international level several times. So a lot of title holders are groundbreakers and leaders and ambassadors, and meeting these women, you know, and this, it's just like, wow, you do that, because the stereotype too also is that a lot of pageant girls are dumb, but like I've met so many engineers, scientists, doctors, dentists. It's just like it's really empowering.
Yeah, I think that's a great perspective, and I do think that there is, yeah, there's space for people, or space for women, to do all kinds of different things and have all different like approaches to their yeah, the way they present themselves and what they participate in and the voice they bring to that. So I think that those are all important aspects.
Yeah. And I think one thing that's really good to note is that many title holders and pageants and systems are moving with the world and becoming, as you know, or not, you know, outdated. So Miss Universe was one of the first systems that allowed for a trans woman to compete. It was Miss Spain, and she did amazing. She looked amazing, did amazing. So you have to think about that. And you have to think about sometimes like the pageant holders in the systems, they had just decided to change like the teen versions to not do swimsuits. They're do like sports and active wear or things like that. And a lot of times too with that, the interview and the speaking are usually the highest or the heaviest weighted portions of the pageant. So sometimes you don't see it, because a lot of times you see the swimsuit and formal gown on stage, but the hardest part, their interview already happened. And so whoever you see on that stage, they are already phenomenal speakers. They're already really good presenters. They're phenomenal speakers. They're good to think on their feet. They're clear-minded, and they have like a mind of their own. They're very strong, independent women. So that's the aspect of two that people overlook. They forget the interview portion, which in most systems weigh the most point-wise than any other category.
Yeah, I think that that's a great point. Yeah, and it goes back to this idea of communication and, you know, public speaking and all those critical things that we need as women in general, as people, but also as, you know, PhDs and people that want to be science communicators and sort of like all these things that, you know, people are striving towards. But I did want to ask, so I know that, so you were protesting for having access to like, you know, rape support and that kind of thing at Purdue. Did you ever feel like there was some stigma associated with being so outspoken on those particular kinds of issues? Did you, and you know, how did you cope with that if you did find that was the case?
So I almost felt at times that I had a target on my back, and I did, because, I remember one time I was called into the office. The assistant head of the department made me sign a waiver that pretty much was like, if you, you know, put the school or department in a bad light, we can pretty much just kind of kick you out of the program. And I signed it. I knew it was illegal. I knew it was illegal, but I just kept it as evidence because I was performing. I was high performing. Like I wasn't just meeting my milestones, but I was excelling them. And so they were saying that if I spoke up about my experiences again, whether it was sexual assault or how I was treated, or just me experience like racism or sexism on campus, they kicked me out of the program. So I had to be like, I was very on edge because I knew I had people watching my socials, which wasn't fair at all or legal. And if you do experience something like that, your school, your department can't, they're not allowed to do that. So, I mean, honestly, I was afraid to seek legal help because I didn't want to get retaliated against. But unfortunately, there is a 2-year statute of limitations. So if something does happen like that to you, immediately go and seek legal advice, go to counsel, see if there's something that you can do to like stop that, or even just sue the department or school, because you are totally in your rights to do so. But even if you stop, or you were outside of the statute of limitations, you can reach out to organizations like fire.org, which is something that I did. And they reached out to the department on my behalf, and they told me that, or they told them that they had to cease, like they said, you have to issue a cease and stop for this, and you can't do that. So what happens is that the assistant head ended up emailing me and saying that, oh, we're negating this contract. It's not a thing anymore, whatever. There's still other things that you can, or other organizations that you can reach out and say, hey, I think I'm being treated unfairly. What are my rights?
That is, it's crazy. It's crazy to think, like, I think that people often think that this kind of corruption at like a university level is just something of the past, but this, you're talking about like, this is so recent, like this is still happening. And it's so frustrating to hear that you had to deal with that kind of intimidation, with that kind of, direct. It's like, it's kind of like passive aggression. That's like direct aggressive action to make you sign a contract like that. Is crazy, but I think you're exactly right, because it, to direct people to like look outside of the university, because I know it can feel quite big to take on something like that. And I'm sure, like, I think it was very brave of you to look elsewhere and try and find assistance for that, because it is such a big thing to take on.
It is, and it can feel scary. And then also too, if you were like, man, I'm just here to get my degree and leave, you're trying your hardest to like keep your head down, do what you can till you graduate. And you don't want to get caught up in like legal stuff while you're there either, because it feels like you're going to have a target on your back. So it is pretty scary.
Yeah. Well, and then after all these experiences, throughout your grad school career, what advice would you give to incoming students, particularly like underrepresented students that are coming into grad school? What do you think that they should, what do you think some of the priorities should be for them to take note of?
To see if they actually feel a part of the environment, to see if they like feel at home, trust their gut when they're interviewing. If you interview somewhere and something feels off about a place, or you don't like the vibes, you don't like the atmosphere, you don't see a lot of students who are diverse or see faculty who are diverse, it's probably not a good sign. It's probably not a good department. But also too, if you're in a department and you know that you're a sociable person and no one's really sociable, that should be like clues for you too. So it's really about like fitting in, but also fitting in like personality wise. Like, are you a good fit in the department? Like when you interview for enough programs, you'll start to pick up on if a program is so competitive that they don't like each other and they're destroying people's experiments or sabotaging them. Or if it's just a program that is competitive, but everybody is trying to reach a success bar. So everyone is looking out for each other to like help matriculate and get out. That's a totally different vibe than people like doing stuff against you behind your back. So definitely interview, definitely talk, trust your gut, look at the makeup of the department, see how people are treating you when you're coming in, if they're making time for you. Also talk to students one-on-one, talk to past students, talk to students who don't have any, you know, more any power underneath their old PI, or they're not associated with their old PI, so that they can tell you the truth about that PI or that person. But yeah, just always keep your eyes and ears open and trust your gut.
Yeah, I think that that's great advice. And then, you know, also, I think that you pointed out this earlier, like building that network outside of the department too, or out, you know, amongst other kinds of peers, so that if you do find yourself in a sketchy situation, you have support networks that aren't totally in that department or in that situation that you're into.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, where can people find you online if they want to reach out, or if they want to connect with you?
So I am on Instagram and Twitter. My Twitter is TI_ENJOLI. It's Tianjali. And also my Instagram is PSLove_T. And I'm more than happy to, like, you know, direct any questions. Also, too, if you're involved in Neuro, please go check us out, Black and Neuro. Black and Neuro Week is coming up. It'll be the last week of July. We've got some really excited events coming out for you guys. So keep a watch.
Yeah, we'll definitely tune in. We'll put all that info in the show notes as well, so you can scroll down on your podcast to find that information. Mm-hmm. But yeah, thank you so much for joining us here. It was wonderful to speak with you, and so rewarding to hear about your experience and all that you've come through in grad school.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, this has been Grad Chat by PhD Balance. Our episodes are now posted on our podcast and YouTube channel on Saturdays. To find our podcast episodes, just search Grad Chat on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can connect with PhD Balance on our website, phdbalance.com, or over on Twitter and Instagram at PhD_balance. Until next time, bye y'all, and take care of yourselves.